From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On July 1st, Los Angeles Mayor-elect Antonio Villaraigosa will take office, the first Latino to do so in 133 years. He energized the Latino vote to historic levels and successfully built a multiracial coalition. And Republican and Democratic heavyweights are taking note. One out of every seven people in the United States now is Hispanic, making Latinos the fastest-growing minority in America today. They are a powerful new force politically and economically. They're buying homes and starting small businesses, winning office and exercising unprecedented political clout. Tonight on Point, surging Latino power in L.A. and across the country. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you see a growing Latino presence in your city, your hometown? How do you see Latinos reshaping American politics today? We invite you to join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we begin from Miami with Ariane Campo-Flores, the Miami Bureau Chief for Newsweek. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, you probably know these numbers as well as anyone does. A newly elected Latino mayor in Los Angeles, first in 133 years. There are 6,000 Hispanic elected officials around the country, including two new U.S. senators. Do you see this as the tipping point for Latino elective power?
I don't know if it's quite as dramatic as a tipping point, but it's certainly a decisive moment in the history. I mean, you know, this is second largest city in the country. Obviously an incredibly diverse place, an incredibly unmanageable place. And to have a Latino candidate emerge who was able to put together the kind of coalition, the winning coalition that he did, which was composed of so many different racial and ethnic groups, and, you know, to now be leading or about to lead that city is, you know, it's a notable development. And it sort of speaks to both the viability of Latino candidates in positions of, you know, in sort of the highest positions of power, and also to the strength of a Latino voting base, which was highly energized in this case in some of the precincts that were examined in Los Angeles that were heavily Hispanic. The turnout rates were higher than they were in some of the non-Latino precincts. So it shows both, you know, the potential power of Latino candidacies and Latino voters.
Well, and how did he do it this time? Because he had run for mayor before unsuccessfully. What did he do better this time?
Well, he had the advantage that, you know, this time around, voters had gotten to know James Hahn, his opponent, and decided that they didn't quite like him so much. So that we can't understate the significance of having an unpopular incumbent. You know, Hahn had done a number of things. He was sort of a lackluster mayor. He, with the black constituency in particular, had been quite a letdown. He dismissed the black police chief in Los Angeles, and voters did not forget that. But you know, Villaraigosa is also an incredibly agile campaigner. He reached out very effectively to a variety of groups that make up the multicolored mosaic in Los Angeles. He incessantly wooed the black leadership, secured endorsements from people like Representative Maxine Waters, who 4 years ago had supported his opponent. You know, he regularly visited black churches and reached out to community leaders. But, you know, he was also paid attention to all the other important constituencies in Los Angeles, the, you know, voters, more conservative white voters in the Valley, Jewish liberal voters on the west side of the city. So it was a kind of a combination of both of those things.
Let's draw back for a minute and widen the lens to a bigger picture here and ask what this means for party politics, national party politics, and particularly for Democrats.
Well, you know, Democrats are still licking their wounds from, you know, what happened last November, particularly on the Hispanic front. By most accounts, those who were involved in the campaign, they feel that the Kerry campaign and the Democrats generally botched their Hispanic outreach. And, you know, this is something that they had, that the Latino operatives had been warning the party about for a while, that you need to, you cannot take this, this vote for granted. Latino voters should not be considered a base constituency. They should be considered a swing constituency, which means that each election cycle you need to get out there, talk to them, you know, speak to them about the issues that they care about, speak to them in the ways that they'll respond to, and really energize them, because they're not, they are not going to be like, for instance, the black vote, which is, you know, there was some slight erosion there, but that's still, you know, very largely a Democratic vote. So, you know, the lessons for Democrats are that you really need to get out and energize that vote, and so they're looking to what Villaraigosa did in Los Angeles and really getting that Latino constituency fired up. I mean, he got 84% of the vote. And, you know, and the Democrats really need to do a lot of kind of rejiggering and rethinking of the way they look at Hispanic outreach.
Mm, and clearly don't take them for granted. Ariane Campoflores, stand by for a moment, if you will. I want to bring in from New York Rodolfo de la Garza, who is professor of political science at Columbia University and vice president of research at the Tomas Rivera Policy Institute. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
I wonder if you'd pick up on what we were talking about just a moment ago about not taking this community for granted. What do you see as the political lessons here for both Democrats and Republicans?
Well, I don't see the lessons quite as sharply as were just described. That is, one of the patterns that we've seen is a reduction in the identification as Democrats. There can be no doubt about that. But when we look at how people vote, and I don't want to get technical, but there's a variety of ways of measuring that, but let's take the simple gross measure. There's no doubt about that reduction, okay? But when you look at how people vote, Latinos are voting in cities like L.A., and we're talking about big elections, in cities like L.A., New York, San Antonio, a little bit exceptional. Illinois, Chicago, they're voting at 75% plus Democratic. This was true in 2004. The really interesting question, given the way we run elections, is would the Democrats have been better off had they really gone after and energized the Latino vote? The answer is no. What they would have done is carried New York by a bigger margin, carried California by a bigger margin, lost Texas by a smaller margin, and won Illinois by a bigger margin. They wouldn't have gotten more votes.
Well, let me ask you for the bigger picture here as well, Rodolfo de la Garza. Do you see the face of American politics becoming increasingly Latino? Is this simply a matter of time?
Well, the answer is, the way you phrase the question, there's no way to answer it. What I would say is Latinos are moving into American politics. There can be no doubt about that. How will that change American politics has to do with how I would answer your question. Do Latinos bring different agendas to the table? Not really. Do they, Latinos overwhelmingly share American values? They're extremely committed to American main core values. What they demand are better schools. Their education is their top demand. They demand different kind of an economic response, the role of the state. They look a lot like good working class Americans. So does that change the face of American politics? It could move it a little bit more in the traditional Democratic way. Do they introduce new issues? The only new issue they introduce, and it's not really a new issue, or the major, if we want to call it, new issue they introduce, is they introduce a broadening of American culture, especially with language. Now, I want to emphasize, this doesn't mean that they're demanding that Spanish be the dominant language, the way a bunch of crazies in the Southwest, my generational legacy, would claim. No, they're not demanding that at all. What they are demanding in a way that has never been accepted in this country and is now becoming legitimate is respect for Spanish. And this respect doesn't mean that they really know Spanish. It means they don't want to be punished for knowing Spanish. And that is a new development. That's a political development around culture that has great significance because immigration is going to continue. It will not stop.
Well, let me ask you to hold that thought there. We're going to continue with our conversation after we take a break. And it does say something telling, though, doesn't it, when the local hamburger stand also offers fajitas. We're talking this hour about Latinos as a powerful new force in American politics today. What does the election of Antonio Villaraigosa signal for the future of Latinos in elected office on a national scale in the House and the Senate? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the new Latino power surge. Are you part of it? Do you see your community coming into its own? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me from Miami is Ariane Campoflores, the Miami Bureau Chief for Newsweek. And also with us from New York is Rodolfo de la Garza, Professor of Political Science at Columbia University and Vice President of Research at the Tomas Rivera Policy Institute. Ariane, I'm curious what the reader reaction was to your cover article about Latino political power. Did most people seem to think that it was about time, or were some perhaps a little threatened by this idea?
We actually got quite a range of responses. We got, on that continuum that you described, letters that expressed both of those sentiments. We did get a lot of people that kind of expressed, pride about having Villaraigosa on the cover and, sort of announcing this Latino power surge. But we also got complaints from some readers that we didn't, for instance, address more in more depth the immigration issue and the many illegal undocumented workers that are in this country and that are, reshaping communities across the country.
Well, and also power surges can lead to power struggles. I wonder what you can tell us about some of the issues between the African-American and the Hispanic communities. Is this notion of a black and brown coalition perhaps more romantic than real?
Well, I quote in the article the Professor de la Garza saying making that point that in most cases, that is kind of a romanticized ideal. I mean, you see a lot of times those sorts of frictions playing out at the local level, because a lot of times you're talking about resource issues and so you'll have, fights that are playing out in school boards and city council meetings. Communities are undergoing a lot of change and sometimes very quick change. Neighborhoods that were once African American have now suddenly transformed and become Hispanic. And so as Hispanics press to become part of the power structure of those communities, that raises some tensions. I remember hearing accounts as well in some of my campaign coverage last year within campaigns, debates about, well, you know, if we take this money and devote it to Hispanic outreach, then that means we're taking money away from the African American outreach, and so that would lead to potential tensions. That shows why it's difficult sometimes to stitch together these coalitions. There was a lot of wariness last time Villaraigosa ran against Hahn in the black community, and he lost abysmally that vote. That changed quite a bit, and part of it, as I mentioned before, is anti-Hahn sentiment, but part of it too was maybe a kind of a greater comfort level that Villaraigosa was able to establish with the black community.
Well, let's go to the source of that quote, as you say, Professor Rodolfo de la Garza. What did the Los Angeles election tell us about the possibilities of a coalition? Because he did get some important significant support within that community this time that he had not had before.
It's very easy to take an important event like Villaraigosa's election and generalize from it to non-comparable situations.
So you think it was more the man than the message?
Yeah, I do. I think it was location and specifics. And let me tell you, because I'll give you a couple of quick examples. Villaraigosa wins in a town where the majority of the vote are non-Latinos. Shortly thereafter, a Mexican-American loses in San Antonio, where the voters either are the majority or very, very close Mexican-American. And simultaneously, in New York City, a Latino is running for office who started out the campaign season for mayor way out front. Now there's even money that he won't even get the nomination because he's doing so badly.
So not a template here necessarily.
And that's really crucial. L.A. represents what San Antonio represented in the 70s. If I can use the image, in San Antonio, Anglos who had fought and kept Mexicans down for generations looked and saw that the Mexicans were there and they were going to keep coming, and they better deal with them now, because if they didn't, they would really pay a great price later. And so they've negotiated. That's what's going on in L.A. In L.A., you look around and you know the Mexicans are coming, and you better deal because they're going to get you one way or another. But Villaraigosa made it clear. He said, I'm the mayor of L.A. I'm proud of my Mexican roots, but I'm the mayor of the city, not of Mexicans. Now, that's a powerful signal out. It is up to Latinos have a great opportunity. In the way that blacks helped make America more democratic through the sacrifice of lives and a century of struggle, Latinos have the opportunity to provide a leadership by reaching out to blacks and going forward. We haven't seen that they've done that very well yet. Villaraigosa is now trying to do that. It's a marvelous example. They can do that. Blacks are legitimately frightened that Latinos will leave them behind because they're doing it numerically. Miami, where our colleague is right now, Latinos and blacks don't do very well. There's been a lot of tension, and some might argue that Latino mobility has been on top of black backs. Well, New York, we don't know how it's going to play, but it's a zero-sum game in New York right now. If you vote Latino, you're voting against black interests. And so blacks are very leery of supporting the Latino candidate. So Latinos, again, the point I really think it's essential here is that Latinos have an opportunity to make the country better by reaching out, because their numbers cannot be denied in the future. Will they have the capacity, the charisma, the political soul to do that? One only hopes.
Well, I want to explore that point a little farther with Barbara Robles, who is joining us from Austin, Texas. She's professor of public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, and a contributor to the forthcoming book, The Color of Wealth, The Story Behind the U.S. Racial Wealth Divide. Welcome to you, Barbara.
Thank you.
Let's continue that point a little bit, because clearly political and economic power often go together. It has certainly been the case for previous immigrant populations, including the Irish. How do you see that playing out? I mean, is the glass more full than empty at this point?
Well, I think that my own optimism is to actually see the glass more full than empty. But I have to echo a lot of what Professor de la Garza has been saying, because he makes some very important points not to forget when we sit down to analyze all the changes that are happening in the Latino population. But I do think one of the points that hasn't been, you know, emphasized as much is that the significance of Latino political leadership in the U.S. has ramifications for North-South relations, as well as, I think, global market expansion. I think one of the things that the U.S. as the mainstream society tends to forget that our immigrant roots actually provide us with a very unique comparative advantage in terms of the economic global changes. We're going to be seeing a lot of Chinese Americans being an asset to the U.S. as China emerges on the national stage as a very important economic player. And I think Latinos we're poised to be an equivalent asset to the U.S. with respect to market relations and globalization.
What do you see at this point as the most encouraging signs, and also what might be the brakes on economic expansion among Latinos?
The biggest break is the one where Rudy was basically telling us that the Latino population is a swing vote in the sense that it votes on issues. And I think the biggest issue that we're going to have in the Latino population is on quality education and access to educational opportunities. What we're seeing right now in terms of public institutions, and here I'm talking about state-supported universities, is a growing significant percentage of the population being admitted to public universities, especially flagships, from the affluent class, and less space for working class and low-income, ambitious youth. And this is problematic, because what it might end up forcing us into is a system that ends up really having a kind of bifurcated higher education system in the U.S., and I'd hate to see that happen, because what we offer in terms of public universities is that educational access and opportunity for everyone, regardless of economic, parental economic status. So that, I think, is one of the possible big breaks on Latino upward mobility.
I want to go to our phone lines now from New York City. We have Eduardo on the line. Hello and welcome.
Hello, thank you. Well, 25 years ago is when I came to the United States, and I lived in Teaneck, New Jersey, where I graduated from high school. Then I moved to Jackson Heights when I purchased my first business. And at that time, most of my other business neighbors were mostly Irish and Caucasians. Now, everything has changed. Northern Boulevard in Jackson Heights, for instance, is very, very Hispanic, very Colombian. It used to be very Colombian and Roosevelt in the 80s, and now it's turning very Ecuadorian, Mexican. In Elmhurst, the zip code were the most multicultural group of people live together. And Corona, Elmhurst, Jackson Heights, is very, very Hispanic. Now, in Corona, for instance, where now we have our house, it used to be quite Italian. Now, as Hispanics are buying those houses, we're moving into the neighborhood. We are getting elected to the new political arena.
And so do you think that's a good thing, Eduardo? Does it make you feel more comfortable to have a mostly Hispanic neighborhood around you, or do you miss the mix of people that used to be there?
Well, I love living in the mix of people. I love that. That's why I live in New York City. But my take here is that what I've been seeing, what's been going on within the past 10 years, 10 years ago, we didn't have a Hispanic elected politician for this area, and now we have so many. We fought 10 years ago. We used to go house by house in order to get signatures to get a Hispanic name in the ballot. And now we have Montserrat, we have Peralta, and we have all these other people that are hopefully will be working for our interests.
Eduardo, thank you so much for the call. I want to pursue that point for a moment with Barbara Robles. This is presumably not happening by accident. How is the Latino community grooming future leaders for political office?
Oh, in terms of political office, I'd batter to Rudy on that point, because I know a lot about community development activists and leaders, but the actual political portion of it is more by example that I've seen, but Rudy would probably have more to say on that.
Well, you know, one of the things that's most interesting is in the old days, whenever those were, ethnic machines produced their own leaders and they moved up. Those have broken down dramatically. A lot of my former students, people like Ken Salazar, the senator from Colorado, was my student. And he learned how to be a politician by living in a state and working with non-Latinos. He didn't stop being a Latino by any means, but his schooling in politics was much broader than that. And so I think the new generation, we have on the verge of maybe have already established a new generation of Latino leadership. And this new generation differs from the one that attacked the battlefront, which has been, like me, they refuse to die. We're displaced. We're dinosaurs. The new generation is the group that knows how to negotiate, for whom being Mexican, and I'm of Mexican origin, where once we had to carry a flag because we were so abused, now you don't do that anymore.
Ariane, I want to bring you back in. Where are you looking to see the next big victory for a Latino candidate?
Well, I think one place to look at which might be interesting is New Jersey, because there we have this is a possibility that's being talked about amongst some Hispanic Democrats, that if Senator Corzine runs for and is elected governor in New Jersey, he would then appoint his replacement, which conceivably could be Bob Menendez, congressman from New Jersey, and the highest ranking Latino in the Congress, at least on the House side. So, you know, and then he would be in position to then be reelected when that term is up. So that's one possibility to look at. Another is to see what happens with Governor Bill Richardson in New Mexico, who's I've seen from recent press accounts has been visiting New Hampshire lately, and as we know, has been on lists for potential VP candidates in the past and may well be on such a list in the future. So I think that in the immediate future are some interesting places to look at. And then for the long term, we haven't quite talked about this yet, but the caller Eduardo was talking about changing neighborhoods in New York. Well, it's interesting to look at the changing composition of states that haven't historically been large recipients of Latino immigrants, places like North Carolina, like Georgia, which are now the states that have the fastest growing Hispanic populations. In North Carolina in the 90s, that was roughly 400%. Georgia was the fastest growing Hispanic population in the past 3 or 4 years. So, I mean, Latinos coming into political power into positions of significant political power in those states is still, you know, quite a ways off, but it's definitely an area that's going to continue to receive these influxes, and those communities are going to continue to change, and their power structure will eventually change.
We need to take a break here, but I'd like to ask all three of you to stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about the new Latino power surge in America. What impact do you see 10 or 20 years from now? How do you see Latino voters, Latino officials shaping America? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the impact of Latinos on American politics and American life. What is the legacy of the more than 41 million Hispanics in America today for its future? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And my guests tonight are Ariane Campo Flores, the Miami Bureau Chief for Newsweek, Rodolfo de la Garza, professor of political science at Columbia University, and from Austin, Texas, Barbara Robles, professor of public affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. And Joe's on the line from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the program.
Good evening. Thank you. I'm pleased to be here. My question is, or perhaps more of a comment, is what's the Latino community doing in terms of preparation for the backlash that is almost certain to follow with the majority of Americans notice that these changes are going on? Because a lot of people haven't yet. You're talking about the states where the Latino population is growing so dramatically, 400% over a short period of time. And I think what's going to happen is there is going to be a backlash. And my fear is that there'll be a backlash to the backlash. And one of the reasons I'm afraid of that is because as long as we continue to think of this as the Latino community, I think we're asking for trouble. I think we're heading for our problems of our own creation in this sense. Because it's when does it cease to be the Latino community, and when are you and I and Latinos and everybody else simply part of a community, on whether it's a national basis or a local basis? When does it cease to be just individuals not being represented as part of the greater whole, but as part of smaller wholes that are pitted against each other and compete for resources or compete for this? When do we look at this as a broader community and not just individuals?
Joe, thank you for the call. Barbara, let me put that one to you first.
Well, I think I'd have to respond in terms of, you know, let's look at our history. You know, here is a country that has been founded on immigration and waves of immigration. And to be identified, I mean, one of the things that struck me in looking at the census numbers is that there's more people who identify as German-American than as simply Americans, 48 million in the last census compared to 25 million. So we're proud of our ethnic roots. We're proud of our immigrant past. And I don't particularly see that as a divisive feature. I see that, if anything, as a feature that indicates to the world, you know, exactly what the U.S. stands for in terms of its democratic principles. I think to talk about a Latino population is, you know, in a sense, we've been a population that's been very invisible. We've been the backbone of much of what I would call the food industry, in terms of farm work. We've been the backbone in terms of many, many service industries, as well as the professions, as well as the military. You know, I think in terms of, and I may be, you know, overemphasizing this, but I think we're one of the highest decorated populations in terms of military service. However, to define yourself as a group does not automatically negate being part of another group. And I think one of the problems that we have is in the U.S., and perhaps this is a socialization part of our public education, looking at things in terms of an either-or instead of the and. And I think we're at a point in the 21st century where the multidimensionality of identities, of individual identities, you know, people being able to claim identity in a variety of different groups, doesn't diminish. In fact, it enhances your ability to be a civic participant and a civic player, I think, both in the political arena and the economic arena. And I think the unfortunate thing with people who haven't been exposed to a variety of ethnic groups, if they didn't grow up in neighborhoods where there were Irish and German and Italians, et cetera, they look at the Latinos as this completely other. And I, you know, I find that, you know, that's not a constructive way to interpret the group. The group is American and new Americans, as well as, you know, all the other new immigrants that the U.S. receives.
To New York City now, Octavio is on the line. Hi, Octavio. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call. And again, I think that the discussion is circling around the idea of Latinos. And to me, the question that I have is, what is a Latino? Being able to speak the language and or the culture. I'm, for example, I'm Panamanian, and oftentimes we are thought as other than Latinos. And myself, and Mexicans, and Peruvians, and Ecuadorians don't necessarily have the same values or ideas.
How do you view yourself?
I definitely share some of the culture. I definitely enjoy the food and the dance and the music. But then I'm outside of a Mexican who might not necessarily have the same struggles. So I wonder if the perception that we are as a coherent group and that we vote as a block is out there. Because I don't necessarily see it, being from Central America, being a Panamanian who is part of the culture. So I guess the question really is, what is a Latino? How is it defined by your guests tonight? And if they do share some common ideals that they look for in their elected officials.
Thanks for the call, and let's put that to Rodolfo de la Garza.
Well, this is a continuous debate. We've dissected this in a multiple manner of ways. But there's a couple of things, despite the fact that when you say salsa, a person from the Dominican Republic begins to dance and a person from Mexico wants to eat, right? The term itself can confuse people, despite what I would call silly, and I want to use the word silly issues in terms of politics, that some people have a little bit of a different language. Some people eat black beans, others don't. Some people eat white rice, others don't. Those aren't real issues. What are the real issues on real political issues? We find an incredible commonality. Latinos of all groups, every time you do surveys, every time you talk to them, want a better education for their kids. This they share. Two, they want economic opportunity. This they share. And what makes them come together is the recognition that sometimes those things are denied them by the fact that they are of Latin origin, that is, they are Spanish-speaking. So the third dimension is they unite strongly against ethnic discrimination, which Latinos have always experienced, but now they all are together on rejecting. So the other dimensions of being Latino, people can argue about, you know, are you a Mexican first or a Latino first? The answer is national origin seems to win the case first, but that is, I'm Mexican and then I'm Latino. But increasingly, among younger people, as well as some not-so-young people, there is a move toward Latino identity. But even more noteworthy, among younger people, there is a move toward an American identity. What are you? I'm an American of Mexican origin, of Panamanian origin. That phenomenon has been rising rather sharply in the last decade.
I want to go to Kim now, who's joining us from Aden, North Carolina. Hello, Kim, and welcome to you.
Oh, thank you so much. I love the show, and I teach at the college, and I recommend all of my students to listen to NPR all the time. It's so wonderful.
Well, thank you. What was your point in terms of the discussion tonight?
The discussion tonight is my concern is that I feel like Latinos, Hispanic populations, and there's lots of diversity among the Hispanic population, is that when people come to America, they need to embrace the culture and appreciate the diversity and what the melting pot builds here in America. I'm very, very concerned about fragmentation of the different populations. I myself, my native language was Korean. Of course, I'm from a very diverse family. My father was French-Canadian. My mother was Scotch-Irish. My dog was German. What can I say? But the reality is we're all Americans, and that's the primary focus, and that should be the primary language. If I want to be Korean, I go to Korea and expect Korean. If I come to America, I think that we all need to appreciate our diversity and appreciate our cultures, and that we share, because just like our restaurants here in America, we have so much diversity in foods, and that's because we're all here. I think one of the things that happens is that the diversity is really looked at differently, because when people look different, like a Russian or Scotch-Irish or German, they may be blonde, blue-haired, whatever, and they look American, so nobody notices anything. A Latino or a Hispanic person, just as an Asian person, they look differently, just like blacks. You know, there are blacks from America, there are blacks from Africa.
Kim, I think we got it. Thank you so much for being with us. And in the couple of minutes we have left, I want to go back to Ariane Campo-Flores, because you bring the eye of a journalist to this discussion. And I wonder, do you see this as the latest version of the classic immigrant story of assimilation, or do you see something different happening here?
Well, there is something different in that the source of all of these immigrants is so close. I mean, what's different about Latino immigration to the United States compared to, you know, the Irish or, you know, the Russians or the Jews of past decades is that, you know, once the immigrants came here, they pretty much stayed here. And while that's the case largely with Latinos as well, there, because of the proximity of the country of origin, there is a continual influx of new immigrants. So these, you know, it doesn't stop. They keep coming from, you know, Mexico or Argentina or Colombia or what have you. And so there will, it's, while you'll have, as successive generations are here in this country, they will gradually blend into the American fabric and change that American fabric as they're blending in. You will continually have those who will arrive and be deemed other by the, you know, the population at large, and will continue to kind of complicate these notions of identity that we've been grappling with and that some of the callers have been raising.
A good place to stop. Ariane Campo-Flores, thanks so much.
Thank you.
He is the Miami Bureau Chief for Newsweek, Rodolfo de la Garza, who joined us from New York, professor of political science at Columbia University. Thank you for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And Barbara Robles, who joined us from Austin, Texas. She's professor of public affairs at the University of Texas in Austin, and also a contributor to the forthcoming book, The Color of Wealth, The Story Behind the U.S. Racial Wealth Divide. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, American high schools move away from the tradition of a single valedictorian. This is On Point. The American Heritage Dictionary defines valedictorian as the student with the highest academic rank in a class who delivers the valedictory at graduation. But more and more across the country, the title valedictorian is being bestowed on large groups of students. Take Garfield High School in Seattle. 406 students, 44 valedictorians, all with perfect 4.0 averages. Bullard High School in Fresno, California, 58 valedictorians. Oregon writer Susan Nielsen is dismayed that the title valedictorian seems to be losing its meaning. In this radio diary, she laments the grade inflation and the coddling culture that wants to turn every student into a valedictorian.
I think a graduating class of seniors should have no more valedictorians than can fit into a convertible. or at absolute most, a compact family sedan. Instead, high schools these days are churning out 10 or 15 valedictorians a year. The number seems to grow every June as grade inflation works its magic. Pretty soon, the typical senior class won't be able to fit all of its valedictorians into a bus. Come on, people. Senior classes should have one valedictorian and one salutatorian. The reasons are simple. First, this honor doesn't count towards college admissions. Students have nothing to lose but their pride and nothing to gain but a little perspective. Second, the words valedictorian and salutatorian actually mean something. The role should be a ceremonial duty for two scholars representing the senior class on graduation day. Two academic ambassadors, two students waving from the convertible, not a herd of 15 on the back of a flatbed truck. For the record, valedictorian isn't Latin for every student who gets straight A's. Traditionally, the valedictorian is the senior who delivers the farewell speech at commencement. Usually, that student is highest in scholastic rank in the class. The salutatorian, who typically has the second highest rank, delivers the welcoming speech, the salute. This tradition worked better when A grades were reserved for extraordinary achievement. But today, A grades are common and practically mandatory for college-bound students. Students know a single B-plus can make their class rank plummet. And since many colleges take class rank into account, students become understandably obsessed with rank and grade point average. High schools end up with gobs of seniors with straight A's who tie for valedictorian. Picking one student invites nasty calls from parents and sometimes inspires lawsuits. No wonder so many schools just decide to honor them all. In my hometown of Portland, the public high schools averaged 7.3 valedictorians per graduating class. That's a lot of people, especially if you have to listen to 7.3 speeches. But these schools showed merciful restraint compared to some others. One local suburban school had 21 valedictorians, and one high school up north in Seattle tapped 44 students to be valedictorian, or about 10% of its graduating class. At that point, it's no longer an honor. It's just embarrassing not to qualify. No offense to deserving seniors, but there's something about multiple valedictorians that makes a commencement feel like a cross between a little league banquet and a legal settlement. Everybody wins, or else. This fall, valedictorians will go to college and realize their title doesn't matter. Maybe they'll see the desiderata on a poster in a dorm room somewhere and study that wonderful line about never comparing yourself to others, lest you become vain and bitter, for always there will be greater and lesser persons than yourself. Over time, they'll learn the difference between friendly competition and obsessive ranking. That's when they'll begin to grow up and compensate for whatever they didn't learn, crammed on the platform with 43 other valedictorians on high school graduation day.
Susan Nielsen lives in Portland, Oregon. She is a columnist for the Oregonian newspaper. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.